Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
How does Barbara cope with the loss of her handsome Edmund? Can Lord Uplandtowers use this to exact a cruel revenge? Thomas Hardy, today on the Classic Tales podcast. Welcome to this vintage episode of the Classic Tales podcast. Thank you for listening. We will be releasing two vintage episodes each week, so be sure to check your feed regularly. New episodes will be available every Friday. If you like the vintage episodes, please let us know by going to ClassicTalesAudiobooks.com. Become a supporter, tell your friends, order an audiobook, or send us an email. We'd love to hear if you like the older episodes. T.S. Eliot said that Barbara of the House of Grebe would seem to have been written solely to provide a satisfaction for some morbid emotion. Looking back on this production, I'm rather inclined to agree. When you think about why this story was written, or what message it's trying to convey, it may be simply to scratch some dark and murky itch. See how far you can go, kind of thing. In short, the ending of this story is pretty dark. Just a heads up. And now, Barbara of the House of Grebe, Part 2 of 2, by Thomas Hardy.
On recovering from her surprise, Barbara's remorse was such that she felt herself absolutely unforgivable. She should have regarded him as an afflicted being, and not have been this slave to mere eyesight, like a child. To follow him and entreat him to return was her first thought. But on making inquiries, she found that nobody had seen him. He had silently disappeared. More than this, to undo the scene of last night was impossible. Her terror had been made too plain, and he was a man unlikely to be coaxed back by her efforts to do her duty. She went and confessed to her parents all that had occurred, which indeed soon became known to more persons than those of her own family. The year passed, and he did not return, and it was doubted if he were alive. Barbara's contrition for her unconquerable repugnance was now such that she longed to build a church aisle or erect a monument and devote herself to deeds of charity for the remainder of her days. To that end, she made inquiry of the excellent parson under whom she sat on Sundays at a vertical distance of a dozen feet. But he could only adjust his wig and tap his snuffbox, for such was the lukewarm state of religion in those days, that not an aisle, steeple, porch, east window, Ten Commandment board, lion and unicorn, or brass candlestick was required anywhere at all in the neighborhood as a votive offering from a distracted soul. The last century contrasting greatly in this respect with the happy times in which we live, when urgent appeals for contributions to such objects pour in by every morning's post, and nearly all churches have it made to look like new pennies. As the poor lady could not ease her conscience this way, she determined at least to be charitable, and soon had the satisfaction of finding her porch thronged every morning by the raggedest, idlest, most drunken, hypocritical, and worthless tramps in Christendom. But human hearts are as prone to change as the leaves of the creeper on the wall, and in the course of time, hearing nothing of her husband, Barbara could sit unmoved, whilst her mother and friends said in her hearing, "Well, what has happened is for the best." She began to think so herself. For even now she could not summon up that lopped and mutilated form without a shiver, though whenever her mind flew back to her early wedded days, and the man who had stood beside her then, a thrill of tenderness moved her, which, if quickened by his living presence, might have become strong. She was young and inexperienced, and had hardly, on his late return grown out of the capricious fancies of girlhood. But he did not come again. And when she thought of his word, that he would return once more if living, and how unlikely he was to break his word, she gave him up for dead. So did her parents. So also did another person, that man of silence, of irresistible incisiveness, of still countenance, who was as awake as seven sentinels when he seemed to be as sound asleep as the figures on his family monument. Lord Uplandtowers, though not yet 30, had chuckled like a caustic fogey of 80 when he heard of Barbara's terror and flight at her husband's return, and of the latter's prompt departure. He felt pretty sure, however, that Willows, despite his hurt feelings, would have reappeared to claim his bright-eyed property if he had been alive at the end of the 12 months. As there was no husband to live with her, Barbara had relinquished the house prepared for them by her father, and taken up her abode anew at Shane Manor, as in the days of her girlhood. By degrees the episode with Edmund Willows seemed but a fevered dream, and as the months grew to years, Lord Uplandtowers' friendship with the people at Shane, which had somewhat cooled after Barbara's elopement, revived considerably, and he again became a frequent visitor there. He could not make the most trivial alteration or improvement at Nollingwood Hall, where he lived, without riding off to consult with his friend Sir John at Shane, and thus putting himself frequently under her eyes, Barbara grew accustomed to him, and talked to him as freely as to a brother. She even began to look up to him as a person of authority, judgment, and prudence, and though his severity on the bench towards poachers, smugglers, and turnip-stealers was matter of common notoriety, she trusted that much of what was said might be misrepresentation. Thus they lived on till her husband's absence had stretched to years, and there could be no longer any doubt of his death. A passionless manner of renewing his addresses seemed no longer out of place in Lord Uplandtowers. Barbara did not love him, but hers was essentially one of those sweet pea or with wind natures which require a twig of stouter fibre than its own to hang upon and bloom. Now, too, she was older, and admitted to herself that a man whose ancestor had run scores of Saracens through and through in fighting for the site of the Holy Sepulchre was a more desirable husband, socially considered, than one who could only claim with certainty to know that his father and grandfather were respectable burgesses. Sir John took occasion to inform her that she might legally consider herself a widow, and in brief, Lord Uplandtowers carried his point with her, and she married him, though he could never get her to own that she loved him as she had loved Willows. In my childhood, I knew an old lady whose mother saw the wedding, and she said that when Lord and Lady Uplandtowers drove away from her father's house in the evening, it was in a coach and four, and that my lady was dressed in green and silver, and wore the gayest hat and feather that ever was seen, though whether it was that the green did not suit her complexion or otherwise, the Countess looked pale, and the reverse of blooming. After their marriage, her husband took her to London, and she saw the gaieties of a season there. Then they returned to Nollingwood Hall, and thus a year passed away. Before their marriage, her husband had seemed to care but little about her inability to love him passionately.
"Only let me win you," he had said, "and I will submit to all that."
But now her lack of warmth seemed to irritate him, and he conducted himself towards her with a resentfulness which led to her passing many hours with him in painful silence. The heir presumptive to the title was a remote relative, whom Lord Uplandtowers did not exclude from the dislike he entertained towards many persons and things besides, and he had set his mind upon a lineal successor. He blamed her much that there was no promise of this, and asked her what she was good for. On a particular day in her gloomy life, a letter, addressed to her as Mrs. Willows, reached Lady Uplandtowers from an unexpected quarter. A sculptor in Pisa, knowing nothing of her second marriage, informed her that the long-delayed life-size statue of Mr. Willows, which, when her husband left that city, he had been directed to retain until it was sent for, was still in his studio. As his commission had not wholly been paid, and the statue was taking up room he could ill spare, he should be glad to have the debt cleared off and directions where to forward the figure. Arriving at a time when the Countess was beginning to have little secrets, of a harmless kind, it is true, from her husband, by reason of their growing estrangement, she replied to this letter, without saying a word to Lord Uplandtowers, sending off the balance that was owing to the sculptor, and telling him to dispatch the statue to her without delay. It was some weeks before it arrived at Nollingwood Hall, and, by singular coincidence, during the interval she received the first absolutely conclusive tidings of her Edmund's death. It had taken place years before in a foreign land, about 6 months after their parting, and had been induced by the sufferings he had already undergone, coupled with much depression of spirit, which had caused him to succumb to a slight ailment. The news was sent her in a brief and formal letter from some relative of Willows's in another part of England. Her grief took the form of passionate pity for his misfortunes, and of reproach to herself for never having been able to conquer her aversion to his latter image by recollection of what nature had originally made him. The sad spectacle that had gone from earth had never been her Edmund at all to her. Oh, that she could have met him as he was at first. Thus Barbara thought. It was only a few days later that a wagon, with two horses, containing an immense packing case, was seen at breakfast time, both by Barbara and her husband, to drive round to the back of the house. And by and by they were informed that a case labeled Sculpture had arrived for her ladyship.
"What can that be?" said Lord Uplandtowers.
"It is the statue of poor Edmund, which belongs to me, but has never been sent till now," she answered.
"Where are you going to put it?" asked he.
"I have not decided," said the Countess. "Anywhere, so that it will not annoy you."
"Oh, it won't annoy me," says he.
When it had been unpacked in the back room of the house, they went to examine it. The statue was a full-length figure, in the purest Carrara marble, representing Edmund Willows in all his original beauty, as he had stood at parting from her when about to set out on his travels, a specimen of manhood almost perfect in every line and contour. The work had been carried out with absolute fidelity.
"Phoebus Apollo, sure," said the Earl of Uplandtowers, who had never seen Willows, real or represented, till now.
Barbara did not hear him. She was standing in a sort of trance before her husband, as if she had no consciousness of the other husband at her side. The mutilated features of Willows had disappeared from her mind's eye. This perfect being was really the man she had loved, and not that later pitiable figure, in whom tenderness and truth should have seen this image always, but had not done so. It was not till Lord Uplandtowers said roughly,
"Are you going to stay here all morning worshipping him?"
that she roused herself. Her husband had not till now the least suspicion that Edmund Willows originally looked thus, and he thought how deep would have been his jealousy years ago if Willows had been known to him. Returning to the hall in the afternoon, he found his wife in the gallery whither the statue had been brought. She was lost in reverie before it, just as in the morning.
"What are you doing?"
he asked. She started and turned. "I'm looking at my statue, to see if it is well done," she stammered. "Why should I not?"
"There's no reason why," he said. "What are you going to do with the monstrous thing? It can't stand here forever."
"I don't wish it," she said. "I'll find a place." In her boudoir there was a deep recess, and while the Earl was absent from home for a few days in the following week, she hired joiners from the village, who, under her directions, enclosed the recess with a panelled door. Into the tabernacle thus formed, she had the statue placed, fastening the door with a lock, the key of which she kept in her pocket. When her husband returned, he missed the statue from the gallery, and, concluding that it had been put away out of deference to his feelings, made no remark. Yet at moments he noticed something on his lady's face, which he had never noticed there before. He could not construe it. It was a sort of silent ecstasy, a reserved beautification. What had become of the statue he could not divine, and growing more and more curious, looked about here and there for it, till, thinking of her private room, he went towards that spot. After knocking, he heard the shutting of a door and the click of a key. But when he entered, his wife was sitting at work on what was in those days called knotting. Lord Uplandtowers's eye fell upon the newly painted door where the recess had formerly been.
"You have been carpentering in my absence, then, Barbara," he said carelessly.
"Yes, Uplandtowers."
"Why did you go to putting up such a tasteless enclosure as that, spoiling the handsome arch of the alcove?"
"I wanted more closet room, and I thought that as this was my own apartment—"
"Of course," he returned.
Lord Uplandtowers knew now where the statue of young Willows was. One night, or rather in the smallest hours of the morning, he missed the Countess from his side. Not being a man of nervous imaginings, he fell asleep again before he had much considered the matter, and the next morning had forgotten the incident. But a few nights later, the same circumstances occurred. This time he fully roused himself, but before he had moved to search for her, she returned to the chamber in her dressing gown, carrying a candle which she extinguished as she approached, deeming him asleep. He could discover from her breathing that she was strangely moved, but not on this occasion either did he reveal that he had seen her. Presently, when she had lain down, affecting to wake, he asked her some trivial questions.
"Yes, Edmund," she replied absently.
Lord Uplandtowers became convinced that she was in the habit of leaving the chamber in this queer way more frequently than he had observed, and he determined to watch. The next midnight he feigned deep sleep, and shortly after perceived her stealthily rise and let herself out of the room in the dark. He slipped on some clothing and followed. At the further end of the corridor, where the clash of flint and steel would be out of hearing from one in the bedchamber, she struck a light. He stepped aside into an empty room till she had lit a taper and had passed on to her boudoir. In a minute or two, he followed. Arrived at the door of the boudoir, he beheld the door of the private recess open and Barbara within it, standing with her arms clasped tightly round the neck of her Edmund and her mouth on his. The shawl which she had thrown round her nightclothes had slipped from her shoulders, and her long white robe and pale face lent her the blanched appearance of a second statue embracing the first. Between her kisses, she apostrophized it in a low murmur of infantine tenderness.
"My only love, how can I be so cruel to you, my perfect one, so good and true? I am ever faithful to you. Despite my seeming infidelity, I always think of you, dream of you, during the long hours of the day and in the night watches. Oh, Edmund, I am always yours."
Such words as these, intermingled with sobs and streaming tears and disheveled hair, testified to an intensity of feeling in his wife which Lord Uplandtowers had not dreamed of her possessing. Says he to himself,
"This is where we evaporate. This is where my hopes of a successor in the title dissolve. This must be seen to, verily."
Lord Uplandtowers was a subtle man when once he had set himself to strategy, though in the present instance he never thought of the simple stratagem of constant tenderness. Nor did he enter the room and surprise his wife as a blunderer would have done, but went back to his chamber as silently as he had left it. When the Countess returned thither, shaken by spent sobs and sighs, he appeared to be soundly sleeping, as usual. The next day he began his countermoves by making inquiries as to the whereabouts of the tutor, who had travelled with his wife's first husband. This gentleman, he found, was now master of a grammar school, at no great distance from Nollingwood. At the first convenient moment, Lord Uplandtowers went thither and obtained an interview with the said gentleman. The schoolmaster was much gratified by a visit from such an influential neighbour, and was ready to communicate anything that his lordship desired to know. After some general conversation on the school and its progress, the visitor observed that he believed the schoolmaster had once travelled a good deal with the unfortunate Mr. Willows, and had been with him on the occasion of his accident. He, Lord Uplandtowers, was interested in knowing what had really happened at that time, and had often thought of inquiring. And then the Earl not only heard by word of mouth as much as he wished to know, but, their chat becoming more intimate, the schoolmaster drew upon paper a sketch of the disfigured head, explaining with bated breath various details in the representation.
"It was very strange and terrible," said Lord Uplandtowers,
taking the sketch in his hand.
"Neither nose nor ears, nor lips scarcely."
A poor man in the town nearest to Nollingwood Hall, who combined the art of sign painting with ingenious mechanical occupations, was sent for by Lord Uplandtowers to come to the hall on a day in that week when the Countess had gone on a short visit to her parents. His employer made the man understand that the business in which his assistance was demanded was to be considered private, and money ensured the observance of this request. The lock of the cupboard was picked, and the ingenious mechanic and painter, assisted by the schoolmaster's sketch, which Lord Uplandtowers had put in his pocket, set to work upon the godlike countenance of the statue under my lord's direction. What the fire had maimed in the original, the chisel maimed in the copy. It was a fiendish disfigurement, ruthlessly carried out, and was rendered still more shocking by being tinted to the hues of life, as life had been after the wreck. 6 hours later, when the workman was gone, Lord Uplandtowers looked upon the result and smiled grimly and said,
"A statue should represent a man as he appeared in life, and that's as he appeared." "But 'tis done to good purpose, and not idly."
He locked the door of the closet with a skeleton key, and went his way to fetch the Countess home. That night she slept, but he kept awake. According to the tale, she murmured soft words in her dream, and he knew that the tender converse of her imaginings was held with one whom he had supplanted but in name. At the end of her dream, the Countess of Uplandtowers awoke and arose, and then the enactment of former nights was repeated. Her husband remained still and listened. 2 strokes sounded from the clock in the pediment without, when, leaving the chamber door ajar, she passed along the corridor to the other end, where, as usual, she obtained a light. So deep was the silence that he could even from his bed hear her softly blowing the tinder to a glow after striking the steel. She moved on into the boudoir, and he heard, or fancied he heard, the turning of the key in the closet door. The next moment there came from that direction a loud and prolonged shriek which resounded to the furthest corners of the house. It was repeated, and there was the noise of a heavy fall. Lord Uplandtowers sprang out of bed. He hastened along the dark corridor to the door of the boudoir, which stood ajar, and, by the light of the candle within, saw his poor young countess lying in a heap in her nightdress on the floor of the closet. When he reached her side, he found that she had fainted, much to the relief of his fears that matters were worse. He quickly shut up and locked in the hated image which had done the mischief, and lifted his wife in his arms, where in a few instants she opened her eyes. Pressing her face to his without saying a word, he carried her back to her room, endeavoring as he went to disperse her terrors by a laugh in her ear, oddly compounded of causticity, predilection, and brutality.
"Ho, ho, 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 ho," says he. "Frightened, dear one, eh? What a baby it is. Only a joke, sure, Barbara. A splendid joke. But a baby should not go to closets at midnight to look for the ghost of the dear departed. If it do, it must expect to be terrified at his aspect."
When she was in her bedchamber, and had quite come to herself, though her nerves were still much shaken, he spoke to her more sternly.
"Now, my lady, answer me. Do you love him, eh?"
"No, no,"
she faltered, shuddering, with her expanded eyes fixed on her husband. "He is too terrible. No, no."
"You are sure?"
"Quite sure,"
replied the poor, broken-spirited countess. But her natural elasticity asserted itself. Next morning, he again inquired of her.
"Do you love him now?"
She quailed under his gaze, but did not reply.
"That means you do still, by God," he continued.
"It means that I will not tell an untruth, and I do not wish to incense my lord,"
she answered with dignity.
"Then suppose we go and have another look at him."
As he spoke, he suddenly took her by the wrist and turned as if to lead her towards the ghastly closet.
"No, no, oh no!"
she cried, and her desperate wriggle out of his hand revealed that the fright of the night had left more impression upon her delicate soul than superficially appeared.
"Another dose or two, and she will be cured," he said to himself.
It was now so generally known that the Earl and Countess were not in accord that he took no great trouble to disguise his deeds in relation to this matter. During the day, he ordered 4 men with ropes and rollers to attend him in the boudoir. When they arrived, the closet was open, and the upper part of the statue tied up in canvas. He had it taken to the sleeping chamber. What followed is more or less a matter of conjecture. The story, as told to me, goes on to say that when Lady Uplandtowers retired with him that night, she saw facing the foot of the heavy oak four-poster a tall, dark wardrobe, which had not stood there before. But she did not ask what its presence meant.
"I have a little whim," he explained when they were in the dark.
"Have you?" says she.
"To erect a little shrine, as it may be called."
"A little shrine?"
"Yes. To one whom we both equally adore, eh? I'll show you what it contains."
He pulled the cord, which hung covered by the bed curtains, and the doors of the wardrobe slowly opened, disclosing that the shelves within had been removed throughout, and the interior adapted to receive the ghastly figure, which stood there as it had stood in the boudoir, but with a wax candle burning on each side of it to throw the cropped and distorted features into relief. She clutched him, uttered a low scream, and buried her head in the bedclothes.
"Oh, take it away! Please take it away!" she implored.
"All in good time. Namely, when you love me best," he returned calmly. "You don't quite yet, eh?"
"I don't know. I think... Oh, Uplandtowers, have mercy. I cannot bear it. Oh, in pity, take it away!"
"Nonsense. One gets accustomed to anything. Take another gaze."
In short, he allowed the doors to remain unclosed at the foot of the bed, and the wax tapers burning, and such was the strange fascination of the grisly exhibition that a morbid curiosity took possession of the Countess as she lay, and, at his repeated request, she did again look out from the coverlet, shuddered, hid her eyes, and looked again, all the while begging him to take it away, or it would drive her out of her senses. But he would not do so yet, and the wardrobe was not locked till dawn. The scene was repeated the next night. Firm in enforcing his ferocious correctiveness, he continued the treatment till the nerves of the poor lady were quivering in agony under the virtuous tortures inflicted by her lord, to bring her truant heart back to faithfulness. The third night, when the scene had opened as usual, and she lay staring with immense wild eyes at the horrid fascination, on a sudden she gave an unnatural laugh. She laughed more and more, staring at the image, till she literally shrieked with laughter. Then there was silence, and he found her to have become insensible. He thought she had fainted, but soon saw that the event was worse. She was in an epileptic fit. He started up, dismayed by the sense that, like many other subtle personages, he had been too exacting for his own interests. Such love as he was capable of, though rather a selfish gloating than a cherishing solicitude, was fanned into life on this instant. He closed the wardrobe with a pulley, clasped her in his arms, took her gently to the window, and did all he could to restore her. It was a long time before the Countess came to herself, and when she did so, a considerable change seemed to have taken place in her emotions. She flung her arms around him, and with gasps of fear abjectly kissed him many times, at last bursting into tears. She had never wept in this scene before.
"You'll take it away, dearest. You will," she begged plaintively.
"If you love me."
"I do. Oh, I do."
"And hate him and his memory?"
"Yes, yes."
"Thoroughly?"
"I cannot endure recollection of him," cried the poor Countess slavishly. "It fills me with shame. How could I ever be so depraved? I'll never behave badly again, Uplandtowers, and you will never put that hated statue again before my eyes."
He felt that he could promise with perfect safety,
"Never." said he.
"And then I'll love you,"
she returned eagerly, as if dreading lest the scourge should be applied anew.
"And I'll never, never dream of thinking a single thought that seems like faithlessness to my marriage vow."
The strange thing now was that this fictitious love wrung from her by terror took on, through mere habit of enactment, a certain quality of reality. A servile mood of attachment to the Earl became distinctly visible in her, contemporaneously, with an actual dislike for her late husband's memory. The mood of attachment grew and continued when the statue was removed. A permanent revulsion was operant in her, which intensified as time wore on.
How fright could have effected such a change of idiosyncrasy, learned physicians alone can say.
But I believe such cases of reactionary instinct are not unknown. The upshot was that the cure became so permanent as to be itself a new disease. She clung to him so tightly that she would not willingly be out of his sight for a moment. She would have no sitting room apart from his, though she could not help starting when he entered suddenly to her. Her eyes were well nigh always fixed on him. If he drove out, she wished to go with him. His slightest civilities to other women made her frantically jealous, till at length her very fidelity became a burden to him, absorbing his time and curtailing his liberty, and causing him to curse and swear. If he ever spoke sharply to her now, she did not revenge herself by flying off to a mental world of her own. All that affection for another, which had provided her with a resource, was now a cold, black cinder. From that time, the life of this scared and enervated lady, whose existence might have been developed to so much higher purpose but for the ignoble ambition of her parents and the conventions of the time, was one of obsequious amativeness towards a perverse and cruel man. Little personal events came to her in quick succession. Half a dozen, eight, nine, 10 such events. In brief, she bore him no less than 11 children in the 9 following years. But half of them came prematurely into the world, or died a few days old. Only one, a girl, attained to maturity. She, in after years, became the wife of the Honorable Mr. Beltonley, who has created Lord Dalmain, as may be remembered. There was no living son and heir. At length, completely worn out in mind and body, Lady Uplandtowers was taken abroad by her husband to try the effect of a more genial climate upon her wasted frame. But nothing availed to strengthen her, and she died at Florence a few months after her arrival in Italy. Contrary to expectation, the Earl of Uplandtowers did not marry again. Such affection as existed in him, strange, hard, brutal as it was, seemed untransferable, and the title, as is known, passed at his death to his nephew. Perhaps it may not be so generally known that during the enlargement of the hall for the 6th Earl, while digging in the grounds for the new foundations, the broken fragments of a marble statue were unearthed. They were submitted to various antiquaries, who said that, so far as the damaged pieces would allow them to form an opinion, the statue seemed to be that of a mutilated Roman satyr, or, if not, an allegorical figure of death. Only one or two old inhabitants guessed whose statue those fragments had composed. I should have added that, shortly after the death of the Countess, an excellent sermon was preached by the Dean of Melchester, the subject of which, though names were not mentioned, was unquestionably suggested by the aforesaid events. He dwelt upon the folly of indulgence in sensuous love for a handsome form merely, and showed that the only rational and virtuous growths of that affection were those based upon intrinsic worth. In the case of the tender but somewhat shallow lady whose life I have related, there is no doubt that an infatuation for the person of young Willows was the chief feeling that induced her to marry him, which was the more deplorable, in that his beauty, by all tradition, was the least of his recommendations, every report bearing out the inference that he must have been a man of steadfast nature, bright intelligence, and promising life.
This is BJ Harrison. I hope you've enjoyed this vintage episode of Barbara of the House of Grebe, Part 2 of 2, by Thomas Hardy. We've got more classic horror stories by Edgar Allan Poe, H.P. Lovecraft, Sheridan Le Fanu, and others at ClassicTalesAudiobooks.com. Click on over and check it out. Thank you for joining me today and allowing classic literature to awaken your better self. Please join me every week, and we'll rediscover the greatest stories ever put to paper.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.